For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Ollie Barrett. White House Communications Director Mike Dubker is resigning after just a few months in the job. The move comes as rumours swirl around Washington about a major shake-up amongst US President Donald Trump's top staff. From Washington, Giles Gibson.
According to media reports, Dubke handed in his resignation before President Trump left for his first foreign trip, but offered to stay in post until he returned to Washington from the Middle East and Europe. The communications director only joined the White House team in March and has been fighting against a series of scandals, including the controversial firing of FBI director James Comey. Meanwhile, under pressure, Press Secretary Sean Spicer will reportedly stay in his job for now, but will brief reporters less regularly. Giles Gibson, Washington.
Former Panama dictator Manuel Noriega has died at the age of 83. A government official in Panama says Noriega passed away Monday in a Panama City hospital where he was recovering from surgery for a brain tumour. Kevin McAleese reports.
The former strongman spent the last 25 years behind bars, first in the US state of Florida, then later France, before being moved to Panama in 2011. Noriega took power in 1983 and ran Panama as a military dictator, while simultaneously working as a spy for the Central Intelligence Agency. But that all came to an abrupt end in 1989 when US forces invaded the country, an operation involving some 26,000 US troops. Noriega was arrested and later convicted for a variety of crimes, including murder, racketeering, and drug running. The 83-year-old fell into a coma in March during surgery to remove a benign tumour. Kevin McAleese, Washington.
Heavy rains and winds have accompanied the arrival of Cyclone Mora in South Bangladesh. It's expected to weaken in the next 24 hours as it moves towards northeast India. Wind speeds in Bangladesh have touched 135 kilometres an hour and thousands of homes have been destroyed. The cyclone formed after monsoon rains triggered floods and landslides in Sri Lanka, killing 180 people. Neha Punia reports.
Efforts are on to evacuate 1 million people in southeastern Bangladesh. Fishing boats and trawlers have been asked to stay indoors as well. Low-lying areas of Cox's Bazar and Chittagong are the worst affected, and officials are preparing for massive waterlogging. AFP reports that 20,000 homes of Rohingya Muslim refugees have been destroyed. An advisory has also been issued in northeast India, where heavy rainfall is expected tomorrow onwards. Neha Punia, New Delhi.
Police in Germany have arrested a 17-year-old Syrian suspected of plotting a suicide attack in Berlin. The country's interior ministry says the suspect was detained in the Uckermark in Brandenburg. For breaking news updates, you can follow us on Twitter, at FeatureStory. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Thanks a lot, Ollie Barrett, and a warm welcome to the programme to you. It's Tuesday, May 30th, 2017. My name is Richie Allen. This is your Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, TuneIn Radio and richieallen.co.uk. Tweet me now, between now and the end of the programme. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. You can also email richie at richieallen.co.uk if you want to reach me via the old email.
Broadcasting live from the great city of Manchester, England. This is the Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com. It's the Richie Allen Show, brought to you in association with davidicke.com. And now, live from Manchester, England, here is Richie Allen.
Now, my only guest this Tuesday is the jazz saxophonist, the author, the journalist, and philosopher Gilad Atzmon. He's got a brand new book out, does Gilad. It's called Being in Time, a Post-Political Manifesto. He's in extended conversation with me. I spoke to him earlier on because he's in the middle of a music tour and a speaking tour as well. In fact, he's in Edinburgh this evening, as you and I are chatting right now. He's in Edinburgh. So I spoke with him earlier on. Fascinating conversation. The age of Trump, Wilhelm Reich, Freud, identity politics, the royal families of Europe. We get into a lot, and I think you're going to find it a fascinating conversation. So Gilad is our guest on Tuesday's programme. Hope you had a terrific bank holiday weekend if you're listening to me in Blighty. If you're not, well, you didn't have a bank holiday weekend, but you're welcome to the programme anyway. I want to say a massive hello to a friend of ours, Patricia Braunschweiler. Patricia, hope you're well. Visited Moscow or Moscow, however you say it. I know how you say it. Recently, some interesting pictures on Facebook there. Big friend of ours, big supporter of the Richie Allen Show. Hi, Patricia. Right, well, there's quite a bit to talk about before we hear from Gilad. One or two things I'm going to mention straight away. Do bookmark at davidicke.com/headlines. Book the headline page. Bookmark it even. Book it, bookmark it. Because again, what I talk about tonight, most of it, much of it, all of it covered extensively on davidicke.com/headlines. So Jeremy Corbyn, Theresa May, were on Sky News in Channel 4 last night in conversation with an audience separately, and then they were separately interviewed by Jeremy Paxman. I'm not going to play you any of that or bring you any of that because you've heard it all day today. It's not my job to repeat what you've heard 1,000 times already today. But I found it kind of interesting. I watched it, of course. Spent the afternoon in Warrington yesterday watching Salford Reds. Salford Reds are rising, beating Warrington in the old Rugby League and Super League. Had a great day out yesterday with Tez and with Andy as well. And so I got back and I watched the so-called debates. I'm not going to share that with you, but Jeremy Corbyn was back on television and radio today. And he made an appearance on BBC4's Women's Hour. And the Labour Party are pushing childcare today. And a proposal of theirs in their manifesto to provide free childcare for 1.3 million youngsters. Now, the interview didn't go very well for Jeremy Corbyn. I find it quite amusing, not only what happened to him, but the way it's been reported afterwards. Here's Corbyn on BBC4's Women's Hour talking about providing free childcare for 1.3 million youngsters.
Let me understand then, how much will it cost to provide unmeans-tested childcare for 1.3 million children?
It will obviously cost a lot to do so. We accept that.
I presume you have the figures.
Yes, I do. It does cost a lot to do it. The point I'm trying to make is that we're making it universal so that we are in a position to make sure that every child gets it. And those that can, at the moment, get free places will continue to get them. Those that have to pay won't, and we'll collect the money through taxation, mainly through corporate taxation.
So how much will it cost?
I'll give you the figure in a moment.
You don't know it?
He hasn't a clue. That was his phone buzzing on the desk as well. If you're the eagle-eared, the owl-eared amongst you will have noticed the buzzing. That was his phone. Somebody was frantically trying to ring him to give him the number, as if he could answer a phone on live radio.
You're logging into your iPad here. You've announced a major policy and you don't know how much it'll cost?
Can I give you the exact figure in a moment?
Is this not exactly the issue with people and the Labour Party, which came up under Gordon Brown, that we cannot trust you with our money?
Not at all.
I don't know the figure.
All of our manifesto is fully costed and examined.
You're holding a manifesto, you're flicking through it, you've got an iPad there, you've had a phone call while we're in here, and you don't know how much it's going to cost.
Can we come back to that in a moment?
No,
now. My point is, it's quite troubling. This is a policy you're launching today, Mr. Corbyn, and you don't know how much it's going to cost. It hardly inspires the voters.
I think what is important for the voters to understand is that if we don't invest in our children and we don't invest in them for the future, then they do less well in primary school, less well in secondary school and less well in the future.
But you don't know the cost.
I want to give you an accurate figure.
You see, there's two things going on here. The first thing that's important, I suppose, is that isn't really an issue. It isn't really. Of course, the media make a big issue out of it. I'm sure the presenter was delighted. She made her name by grilling and sticking Jeremy Corbyn to the what's the correct number. But it isn't really much of a big deal, really. Because if it's in their manifesto and the figures are in there and they are signed off by an economist of sorts or an accountant or whatever, That's all that really matters. That's issue number one. Issue number two, also at play there is evidentiary to me, is that there isn't an ounce of humanity in most of these politicians. There isn't an ounce of ability to deal with any situation that hasn't been scripted down to crossing the T's and dotting the I's. I couldn't understand why, and I listened to this live earlier, in fact, I couldn't understand why Corbyn didn't say, do you know what, Emma, it's been an absolute mad couple of days. I can't actually think of it off the top of my head. And I know you're going to say that's a bit silly on a day when you are specifically pushing this childcare policy. But I'm not sleeping much. I'm pretty much doing this 24 hours a day. So forgive me. Give me a minute and I'll get you the figure. But he didn't. He sounded hostile. And he sounded flustered. And he sounded a bit annoyed and a bit angry towards the end of it. It's a nothing story, really. Why am I raising it? Because I was amused by those two very facts. One, it doesn't really matter. Two, it highlighted Corbyn, and they're all the same, these people. What was that? Why does that keep happening? Yeah, Corbyn's inability and his ilk to basically deal with any human situation. You know what? Love, without saying love, that's pretty patronising. But I can't think of it. I'm just a bit knackered this morning. Give me a minute, we'll get you that figure. And we'll tell you, more importantly, we'll tell you how we came to that figure. How about that? God love Corbyn. It's been made a big deal of today. On to a more serious matter. Owen Jones. I don't like him. Can't stand him, really. Because he's everything that Gilad Atzmon will be talking about later on in our conversation. Identity politics. My dot is the only dot. And all of that. But I'm going to give Owen Jones a little bit of credit today. He was debating, and I use the term advisedly, he was debating an American pain in the arse called Kate Andrews. Now, Kate Andrews has popped up on our screens in the last 18 months. She's over here from the States, and she's working for the Institute for Economic Affairs. What is that? Something is going on there. Oh, it's my email, is it? All right, yeah. I better turn it off then, hadn't I? Anyway, I'm being royally distracted here. Right, so Kate Andrews, over here from America, she's on loan from the States, right? Institute for Economic Affairs. She debated Owen Jones on Sky News today. She and Owen Jones are regular talking heads for Sky News. Now, this is the lazy, pseudo-intellectual crap you get from Sky. We want a socialist perspective on something. Who will we ring? Owen Jones, who doesn't represent anybody, really. Anyway, Kate Andrews started this nonsense today about Jeremy Corbyn supporting despots and human rights abusers. Owen Jones was having none of that. This is interesting.
Jeremy Corbyn has repeatedly come out in support of things like Hamas.
He hasn't supported Hamas. He's shown his sympathies there.
And he's shown his sympathies for so many dictatorships across the world if they promote socialist values, like in Venezuela and in Cuba. I think that the British public feels like, and I actually think Paxman did a pretty decent job last night pushing on this idea. Yes, it is absolutely fine that the Labour manifesto is not as radical as Jeremy Corbyn is. Thank goodness. But we know that where his sympathies lie are so much more extreme and so much more socialist he's been willing to defend some pretty awful regimes in the past.
Just on that, on the regimes point, I'm glad you've raised that. Theresa May is literally in an alliance, a strong, staunch alliance, with a Saudi dictatorship which exports international extremism, which is a threat to the national security of this country and the security of people, but not Jeremy Corbyn.
Okay,
just quickly, Jeremy Corbyn has taken a principled stand against the regime, which people watching this programme need to know, is a threat to the national security of this country. The extremism that we've seen all over the world, much of it comes from that regime. Theresa May isn't just supporting it and arming it as they bomb Yemen now with British bombs, and I've been to a refugee camp and met people who fled that horrendous situation, which I'm afraid our government is up to its neck involvement in, but it is having a big impact in terms of spreading radicalisation. If we're going to talk about support for brutal dictatorships and links to extremism, let's have it, and let's talk about what their alliance with the Saudis is.
I think that you and I are actually probably much closer aligned on things like foreign policy issues and where our supports and our money go in particular than we would be on most other issues. But I think that there is a very big difference between potentially having allies and trade allies in particular across the world where they don't support the same level of human rights that we would like to see, because usually those kinds of trade agreements and things like that can help the people in those countries.
Yes, you heard the cheerleader there. And I reckon she has all the brains of a cheerleader. That's a terrible misogynistic thing to say, Richie. There are many very bright cheerleaders. Of course there are. Listen, she's actually making the point there, and it's extraordinary. And again, neither the presenter nor Owen Jones jumped in on her. She's making the point that doing arms deals with dodgy dictators and despots like the Saudis is ultimately good because it contributes ultimately to improving people's lives in those countries. Absolutely mad, Ted. That's a mad, an absolutely mad conclusion to draw. Or excuse to make for doing arms deals with the Saudis. But I thought Owen Jones made a couple of good points before that. Worth playing. The Richie Allen Show, 16 minutes past the hour. Now, the White House Communications Director has resigned today. A guy called Mike Dubke. 3 months after he was hired by Trump. He's a Republican strategist well known in D.C. He was hired in March to revamp the White House media strategy. Now, as part of the shake-up which is taking place, with which has seen Dubke leave his job, we're going to see less of Sean Spicer briefing the media, apparently. He's going to hold on to his job, but we're not going to see so much of him doing media briefings. There are reports of disarray in the White House communications team. Dubke tendered his resignation a couple of weeks back and is leaving on good terms, according to the website which reported his exit, Axios News. Good terms, they're saying, yeah. In the meantime, the Jared Kushner saga rolls on. Is he in league with the Russians? Kushner, in case you don't know who he is, property developer married to Trump's daughter, arch-Zionist friend of Bibi. Right, so the saga rolls on. Is he the mole that was opening back channels with the Russians? Well, former CIA director Michael Hayden cryptically, and I say cryptically, told CNN that there's not much going for the investigation, but there's just enough to keep sniffing around. Here's Hayden with CNN, Michael Hayden.
You're a former intelligence officer. You look at Jared Kushner's behavior here, plus the other things we heard about Trump campaign contacts right. with the Russians. You've pieced together incomplete information many times in your life. What is your best read of that? Do you think it was intentional? Does it look like to you intentional collusion? Or does it look like something more innocent?
I'm not prepared to say it was intentional collusion. I've not seen any evidence of that. People whose judgment I trust, Jim Clapper, John Brennan, although they've left government, said by the time they left, there was no evidence of collusion. But you know, naivete, disrespect for established processes actually lead you into a position where you could be exploited by an adversary. And we might find that to be true.
Now, the thing is, though, Clapper and others have said when they left, no right. evidence, but now you hear, I mean, well, the once FBI director is as recently as March in sworn testimony, and it's our reporting, and you hear from both Republicans and Democrats on the relevant committees that it is still an open question, the question of collusion.
And look, there's enough circumstantial evidence. There are enough kind of difficult to explain context, Jim, that this does deserve a full airing. But I'm not predicting an outcome here. We may, frankly, you know, the most likely outcome from my judgment is a cloud.
Yeah.
With people who thought this was malintended at the beginning being convinced, and those who thought it was innocent and naive will also be convinced.
I can't believe I'm saying it, but brilliant analysis from former CIA director Michael Hayden. That's exactly what's going to happen. Exactly. Nothing will happen. And thousands of television hours and miles of newspaper columns have been given over to this because it's a drama, like I say time and again on this program, a scripted drama. The goings-on in the White House are scripted so that they resemble a series of 24 starring Kiefer Sutherland and produced by 20th Century Fox. It's all a drama. It's a nonsense designed to have people gripped to it, tune in every day and spend countless hours arguing on social media with their friends and neighbours while very serious issues are going on, while very serious things are happening in the world. Yes, of course, I know it has implications for Russia's involvement in Syria. I'm well aware of that. But mostly, it's a complete and utter drama. I want to spend just a couple of seconds talking about Alex Jones of Infowars.com. was brought to my attention by some of the good folks who keep the website at davidicke.com in good nick and who are building the new davidicke.com, that on the evening of the bombing at Manchester Arena last week, Alex Jones went on air and did a piece to camera pretty much just after the bombing. Now, Jones, in the video, which is, you can see it on davidicke.com headlines, starts off by waxing lyrical about how Donald Trump was sticking it to 50 Arab leaders about terrorism. So you know that while just before the bombing happened, in fact, the day before and the day it happened, Trump, of course, was dealing with them. He was in Saudi Arabia. He'd been in Israel as well. Then he'd been meeting the G7, hadn't he? He was doing that as well. And Trump was there, and Jones was waxing lyrical about that great speech Trump gave about how we're going to stop radical Islam and Islamic fundamentalism. So while Alex Jones was doing this piece to camera, talking about Trump sticking it to the Arab leaders and how great Trump is, he also said something that was absolutely reprehensible. Listen to this.
So they're transferred the weapons, they're transferred the technology, they're transferred access into the surveillance grid. And less than 24 hours after President Trump finishes that speech, a big bomb goes off at a pop star's rock concert, bombing a bunch of liberal trendies. The same people, God love them, on average, who are promoting open borders, bringing Islamists in. Trump's been blocking that and saying, you don't come here from unvetted countries.
Yeah, I'm going to play that again so you can hear that again, exactly what he said there, because you might have missed it.
So they're transferred the weapons, they're transferred the technology, they're transferred access into the surveillance grid. And less than 24 hours after President Trump finishes that speech, a big bomb goes off at a pop star's rock concert, bombing a bunch of liberal trendies. The same people, God love them, on average, who are promoting open borders, bringing Islamists in.
Yeah, so what Alex Jones said there was that a bunch of liberal trendies, not men, women and children who never did anything to anybody, but a bunch of liberal trendies were bombed at a concert in Manchester. And the same people, he said, who are in favour of open borders and all this sort of stuff. This is the level of psychopathy and ignorance you're dealing with in the independent media, particularly as it relates to Alex Jones and InfoWars. An utterly indefensible and reprehensible thing to say. But this is the level that much of the independent media, sadly, has been reduced to, making statements and making comments like that. I'm going to leave that there. I didn't know anything about that till today, to be honest with you. But I'm going to leave that. Nothing else needs saying on that. 23 minutes past the hour. All week, last week and this week, I've been fighting with myself not to do a segment on the independent media. There's a lot going on in some sections of the independent media that I've been talking about and I've been relating to the mainstream media. And much of what the mainstream media does to seduce its audience, to misdirect its audience and to distract its audience from reality, much of the independent media is doing the same thing. It's mirroring that. And I wanted to get into it, and I was going to get into it now, but I don't have time. I might do it tomorrow. I might do it on Thursday. But I'm really keen to get into it because it's important stuff. It's important work, I think. And I think it's something that we need to consider when looking at how the so-called independent media operates and how it goes about doing what it does. But in the meantime, it's 24 minutes past the hour. This is your Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2 and TuneIn Radio. Very quick break. When we come back, more Gilad Atzmon in a couple of minutes' time.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. they become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
Richie Allen.
Welcome back. It's 25 minutes past the hour. Tuesday's show. We're live. We're in good form. I'm in good form. Hope you're in good form. It's not a bad old evening in Greater Manchester, in South Manchester. We have Gilad Atzmon in a couple of minutes' time. Before that, good evening to Sean. To Alex Doust. Alex says sometime in the next few years the independent media will be attacked and Jones' tone will change, showing his true colours, though, says Alex. Attacked in terms of, Alex, I guess, attacked in terms of trying to close it down. They're doing that already, mate. Hi to Faisal, who asks, I wonder if both sides are trying to avoid a decisive win so that the Lib Dems will decide an anti-Brexit coalition. That's a possibility, I suppose. Luga tweets, at the end of the day, Richie, it is a system which kills, and Corbyn won't stop the corporate trade with countries like Saudi Arabia, even if he gets in. That's from Luga. And Jay Ferguson tweets, I wish they would stop saying the British public, because they sure as hell don't talk for me. Hi to Spirit Samba as well. Hi to Jason. I hadn't heard the Corbyn interview, Richie. Last time I saw a car crash of those proportions, it was at the end of the Blues Brothers film. Yeah, the Blues Brothers. I remember the Blues Brothers. The late, great Carrie Fisher, John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd, I remember. Ray Charles as well. Great comedy, that. Terrific film. This is the Richie Allen Show for Tuesday, May 30th, 2017. My name is Richie Allen. Gilad Atzmon is with us in a couple of minutes' time after Pearl Jam and a song called Alive. Welcome to the programme. Good to be with you as always. Talk. Eddie Vedder and Pearl Jam on the Richie Allen Show. That's Alive from the album 10. I was in my prime. 17, I think, when that came out. It's exactly 29 minutes to the top of the hour. This is your Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2, TuneIn Radio, richieallen.co.uk. Now, Gilad Atzmon is a legendary jazz saxophonist. He's an author, philosopher, critical thinker. Pretty good guy, very fond of Gilad, and I've known him a few years. You'll remember him from writing such books as The Wandering Who. I caught up with him earlier today because he's promoting at the moment his brand new book called Being in Time, a Post-Political Manifesto. He's currently on a speaking tour and he's on a music tour as well. He's in Edinburgh this evening, hence I spoke with him earlier today. The book is terrific. It really is terrific. I got a copy of it a couple of weeks ago. It's not a long book, about 160 pages, but it's very, very interesting indeed and very timely. So we spoke about that in a wide-ranging conversation. In fact, we spoke about a lot. Have a listen. Listen carefully. Tweet your thoughts, and when it is over, I will read them out. So do that. This is me and Gilad Atzmon in conversation a little earlier today. Gilad, welcome back to the programme. Thanks for taking the call. You're in the middle of a tour at the moment. You're gigging, of course, as well as promoting your new book, which we're going to talk about. How are things going?
Yeah, everything is pretty great. I came back from America. The tour in America, we pretty much done kind of a brief coast-to-coast, and it was a great success. I met some opposition in New York, but the venue owner said, whatever you want to do, you can hold it against me, but I'm not going to cancel this event. You know, we have a First Amendment. Gilad is entitled to say whatever you want to say. I can agree with him or disagree with him. Everything was fine. I'm now kind of decided to schedule a brief tour in the UK. I was initially planning to tour after September to let the book do some work on its own. But David Scott from the UK column suggested that we may be able to do something together. I did one event with him. He's an incredible intellect and I really enjoy sharing stage with him. We decided to put something in the UK, and here we start to face some serious opposition. They mount pressure on venues. Yesterday I was in the Clooney. You know, on the way to the Clooney, I wasn't in the Clooney because on the way to the Clooney, like 1 hour before we reached Newcastle, I called the venue and I realized that the event was canceled. We came to the venue, we found a venue immediately, but an alternative venue, but we met really vile behavior. We have it documented, we will put it on the net in 3-4 days once we are back in London. But really, you know, some of the staff members were really behaving like hooligans, and it's all based on information that they received about me and didn't bother to check out. You know, one of the staff members, and I know his name now, called me a Holocaust denier and so on, by the fact, you know, my crime apparently is that I believe that the Holocaust shouldn't be treated as a religion. And if it is a religion, I insist upon my right to be an atheist.
And to challenge it.
You know. Anyway, so this is all, for me, this is quite good because it, to a certain extent, it proves to me that I'm once again pushing the envelope somehow or touching some sensitivities. The fact that they are so desperate to stop me means that they probably realize that I'm blowing the whistle once again on them, and I'm happily doing. You know, this has become my lifetime adventure, blowing the whistle, not just blowing the saxophone.
Yeah, we'll talk. not just blowing the saxophone. We'll talk more about that as we go on. We're here to talk about the book, which is Being in Time, a Post-Political manifesto by Gilad Atzmon. Of course, our listeners will find links on our Facebook page, on Twitter, and I will get them on our website as well, to where you can buy the book, Being in Time, a Post-Political Manifesto. I've read it. I think it's terrific. It's challenging. It's thought-provoking. We're going to talk about it. Before we do, though, it can be, or it has been argued, that any analyst of any subject, he or she, whether they mean to or not, they bring to bear on their research their own predetermined or their own inherent positions on those subjects, their own absolutes. Do you recognise that as being a possibility?
I'm not so sure that that I understand what you are referring to. Can you be more specific? I don't want to miss
any question. No matter what you're studying, particularly when it comes to politics, it's difficult to be, if not impossible, to be 100% objective and to come at the subject with a blank page, because each and every one of us, through our life experiences, holds a series of absolutes, a series of positions that we hold dear to anyway.
Not only that, I agree with you. I think that the book would actually approve this point of view. In my work, you know, in my contemporary work, in Being in Time, I actually argue that it is all about the distinction between Athens and Jerusalem. Athens is the city of reason. Athens is where we think things through. Athens is the birthplace of philosophy, of ethics, of science, of art. Jerusalem, on the other end, is the city of revelation. There is God, and there is a book that tells us what to do and what not to do. Ten commandments. This is right, this is right, this is right, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. Now, I don't claim to know what is the truth. I don't claim to be objective. In fact, I hardly ever use facts in my argumentations, because in my work, we, the people, are the facts. So when you read my book, you don't look at the world, you look into yourself and ask yourself, is it true? Is it how I feel? Is it how I see things? Or maybe, is it how I should see things? Or maybe I didn't see things right because of different reasons? Because of my education, for instance, my upbringing, and so on and so on. So rather than me presenting what is right, which is exactly the Jerusalemite approach, political correctness, identity politics, the way, the right way to think, the objective way to think, I actually do the complete opposite. Rather than providing many answers, I actually try to train people, including myself, for that matter, how to refine questioning, how to look, how to self-reflect, how to examine things thoroughly and truly. This is my approach.
Do you think? I mean, I'm glad you mentioned facts. It's been argued that we live in a post-fact world anyway. I think we probably do. I'm sure we'll talk about that. Finally, on this point, and then I want to talk about aspects of the book that I really liked and one or two that have left me questioning things myself and other things.
Sure.
But before we do that, do you think you're at a stage of your intellectual development? You're not an old man, not by any means. You're not really even at middle age yet. You're a working musician, writer, philosopher. Do you think you're at a stage where you're capable of encountering ideas that might contradict long-held beliefs that you have? Do you think you're at a stage where your mind can be or could be changed, or you could go another direction if information came to you that challenged core beliefs? What do you think?
I hope. I don't know. I don't know. But I certainly hope. And what is quite interesting for me is that the more I look into this question, and this is a very crucial question, by the time I believe that I reach my ultimate truth or final development, I will obviously retire. You know, I stop playing music, I'll stop to write, I'll stop to read. I'm still an active agent, and some people would say maybe a very active agent, because I believe, for instance, and this is crucial, that history is the attempt to narrate the past as we move along. Why do I say as we move along? Because as we move along, we acquire new notions, new understandings, and then our understanding of the past change accordingly. Which means that our understanding of our own past, of the past of our people, the past of our planet, is a very dynamic notion. Because we revisit, we reopen discourses, and to be precise, we are revising all the time. This is how I came to the conclusion that history, for instance, which is a crucial notion, only becomes meaningful when it is involved revisionism. And now to go back to your question, I hope that I never reach the point where things are clear to me and are profound and beyond questioning.
That's interesting, interesting, because that's something I strive for. I'm not an intellectual. I'm intelligent, but I'm not an intellectual.
You're very intelligent.
I'm reasonably intelligent, but yeah. My ultimate ambition is to reach an understanding of who we are. Now, the book...
But you are totally right about that.
Yeah.
I don't claim to know the truth. However, I'm totally excited by the process of truth seeking. All right? So like you, I'm striving towards understanding of the truth, but I never have claimed to know it, to point at it. I don't know what it is.
Not as long as I've known you anyway. All very, very good books and books which people should read, there are contradictions in there. But I've known you for a few years now, and one of the things I've always really liked about you and your writing is you're quite happy to be sitting right in the middle of a contradiction. I think you take a bit of glee in it at times.
I tend to own my contradictions.
You tend to own them, right? So the book is
big. You know, my existence, at the set, when people ask me, are you a Jew? I say, no, certainly not. I'm an ex-Jew. But then you will find me sometime define myself as a proud self-hating Jew. you cannot establish a greater contradiction. You know, I'm happy to own. I think that being in the world involves some contradiction. Logic, you know, is an abstract notion. It's like math. You know, it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist in the world itself, but we can apply it to things that we are doing.
I'm going to mention again, it's Being in Time, a Post-Political Manifesto, Gilad Asmon, gilad.co.uk. I'm going to read that out several times. We will explore, Gilad talked about history there, we are going to explore a theme of the book, which is that we are nostalgic ourselves as people about an era that never actually existed, about times, and that's fascinating. We're going to get into that, but I want to start out with asking you this. Has the left... Let's leave the right to one side for a minute. Has the left ever really existed? Isn't it an illusion? Isn't it a powerful illusion? This book goes hand in hand, and it's a great follow-up, I think, to work done by the BBC filmmaker Adam Curtis. I really
it's
do
amazing
mean that
you mention it. I feel the same.
This book, yeah. I mean, I'm a big student of Curtis, and this book belongs on libraries with Curtis's work, with his films. It really does. Isn't the left, isn't the right an illusion, but particularly the left, we've never had the left. You've made the point about the recent heroes of the left, Corbyn, Sanders, having, how could they identify with me or you from working class backgrounds? This was a powerful illusion created many, many, many years ago. And I would argue, and that this came out.
I'm totally with you. Do you allow me to
Yes, jump right in. Yep.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. One of the things that the book starts with an attempt to redefine the notion of left and right. And if you allow me kind of 35 seconds, I'll try to elaborate.
You have as much time as you want, Gilad. Go ahead, as much time as you want, mate.
Yeah, it's crucial. I argue that the left tells us what the world ought to be. We are supposed to live in equality, in kind of an egalitarian condition, to share everything and so on and so on and so on. The right tells us what the world is. And the debate between right and left is quite simple. The right would tell the leftist, for instance, you know, I admire your inclinations toward justice. However, you must understand that people aren't equal. And in fact, the most appealing thing about our human landscape is the fact that we are not equal. When you start to look into that, you understand that the left is actually shaped like a dream. It is not referring to what the things are, but what things should be. The right, on the other end, is shaped like insomnia. The difference between left and right is the difference between the night, the dream, and the day, the reality. Between becoming what I wish to be and being what I am. And I realized that the success of liberal democracy, we grew up in, I think that we are the same age, more or less.
Yeah.
We grew up in a liberal democracy. And it was a really fantasy, because we didn't think that things were right. We were upset by a lot of things, by the Vietnam War and so on and so on and so on. But we believed that we possessed the ability to make things better. For instance, we thought that the political system was somehow a reflection of our needs, our values, our whims, and so on and so on. Suddenly, something happened. Suddenly, we realized that this has changed. We were suddenly reduced, we don't know exactly when, but we were reduced into consumers. And the politicians, rather than serving us, working for us, started to work for big money, facilitating consumption by means of credit. They were working for the big money guys, for the bankers and so on and so on. They had nothing to do with us. Now, we go back to the left and right. I realized that at the time of liberal democracy, you know, left and right were fighting each other day and night. Yet this fight was in fact a reflection of the human condition. It was the battle between the dream and the day, between the night and the day, between the dream and the real. And so on and so on. And this is why it was so forceful. Left and right were complementary poles. There was a dialectic going on. Now, this has changed. Now, when we look in retrospectives at the left, except some rare moments in its history, never bonded with the working people. The left always presented itself as the voice of the working, of the proletarian, and so on and so on.
But it was never meant to be, was it, Gilad? It was never meant to be.
It never happened. And I explain in the book why. It is very simple. Because working class go to work. When you come to working class people and you tell them, listen, tomorrow We meet near to the BBC at 12 o'clock. We are starting a revolution. Tell you, I can't. Can you do it on weekend? I have to go to work tomorrow. Working class are working people, and the left were always, or the leftists, different types of Guardian readers. Yeah, what do I try to say by that? As much as I liked Jeremy Corbyn for quite a long time, you know, I was one of the first people to support him and was also one of the first people to admit, probably the first, to admit that he is failing big time. And I wish him luck, by the way, in the election. It's not, I'm not kind of anti-Corbyn. I'm not running a political campaign here. I'm an apolitical person, you know. But there is one thing that is very clear to me about Corbyn. You know, the guy isn't a working class person. He didn't work a single day in his life. I mean, a proper job.
Yes.
Going to factory like my father.
9 to 5, yeah.
You know, 9 to 5. And the same apply to Bernie Sanders. The same apply to Bernie Sanders. And probably the same applies to Trotsky. And all those Bolsheviks and people who want to change the world. And you come to the conclusion that basically left-wing people are basically middle class who know what is better for the working class. Now, if you look at the demography of Britain and the way people split on the polls, it is quite shocking to find out that the working class still don't vote Labour. And this is something that some Labour enthusiasts are very upset by. But it is very.
I know a lot of trade unionists, particularly here in Manchester, where I'm I won't say I'm clued in, but I am tuned in to some pretty well-known trade unionists in the city. And they would argue with that. They would say that among the trade unions, which obviously goes without saying, but among those whom they represent, you know, the various unions, the workers they represent, that Corbyn would be very popular, they would argue.
Yeah, but you know, yes, it's interesting. Yesterday, you know, my as I mentioned, the talk moved to a new venue, I had a trade unionist who is a person whom I know for years. He actually showed me yesterday a picture. He visited Gaza in 95 and met Arafat. As a British as a representative of the trade unions here. So, you know, he was high up. And I was afraid to offend him. But at a certain stage, I started to talk about the fact. And this is my biggest problem with Corbyn, really. When I saw that he didn't stand up for his party members who had something to say about Jewish power, about Israel, about Kevin Livingstone telling the truth, the absolute truth about the Holocaust.
Yeah.
I was really troubled. And something slightly...
Hang on a second. I'm not accepting you saying you were troubled. You should have known better. You've been around the block as many times as I have.
So
I would be amazed if you were surprised that Jeremy Corbyn backed down in the face of threats from the Jewish lobby.
By the way, to tell you the truth, when we saw Corbyn actually surrendering to the lobby pretty much 10 days in, he seek to make peace with them and so on and so on. And I said, maybe he's a really, really nice guy. By the way, I think that he is a nice guy, you know, but I was very quick to realize that nothing is going to happen. Now, let's talk about the real politics.
Just before we do, can I make a point I think it's important to make? We are a tiny we. It's not the royal we. It's a tiny we. We, in terms of the people associated with this program. When I say associated, me, my editor, my video editor, and my website manager. There's just three of us. We would believe that parliamentary democracy came out of the European royal family's understanding that their hold on their populace, whichever country it was in, was becoming shaky as people were rebelling against the idea of monarchy-controlled countries. And that through alliances made between those royal families, including the royal family of this country, and the banking families of the world, what came out of that was a very clever creation, and that was the creation of democracy and the left-right paradigm. That's why I keep going back to the illusion
I'm totally with you. I'm totally with you. And you can even extend it, this kind of, this type of research, and look at the Enlightenment, which is not a political system. It's an anthropocentric shift in human understanding. You know, you look at that and you think, oh, it's Enlightenment, and we see ourselves and we become subjects and become individuals. And when you look into it deeply, you understand that in practice, this was a bourgeoisie, very successful attempt to actually fight with the monarchs of their time, especially in France and Central Europe.
Yeah.
If you look at the, you do the same thing with slavery, you know, you think it's quite beautiful that the American people defy slavery, but did they do it because it was a humanist or empathic concern? Not really. It was, again, a money battle between the North and the South. And this is exactly, we're going back, as you see, it's not just the Holocaust. This is the real meaning of being in the world, is the ability to look at the past as you move along, to revise the past, because you gain a new understanding, a new way to look at things. You are slightly more clever than you were yesterday. And the same applies to the past. If the past is completely different than your vision of the future, one of the biggest problems that we have with the left and right, the false dichotomy and so on and so on. I argue, by the way, you read the book, that false right is a false dichotomy. And this is why it doesn't exist anymore. You know, this is a real big problem. This is a real, it's not a big problem once we know it. And we understand that we have to establish a new form of understanding of our political system, or what it is reduced into, and we find our place within it. Because at the moment, we don't. We are subject to a lot of changes, and I argue that academia failed to warn us about it. The media failed to warn us about it. And in fact, when I have to put it into just few words, if the West was largely an Athenian environment, it is now solely Jerusalemite and under the domination or the helm of Jerusalemite ideology. By the way, when I say Jerusalemite, I don't mean Jews. I mean the concept of law, political correctness, tyranny of correctness. Hillary Clinton is not a Jew. She's a profound Jerusalemite. The same applies to Tony Blair. To a certain extent, and I'm saying it with pain, and forgive me, please forgive me for not being as rude with Corbyn as I should. Even Corbyn is a Jerusalemite. And I give you a great example. 2 days ago, 3 days ago, after this awful Manchester event, Corbyn came with a revelation. I opened my eyes and the BBC announced within a few hours Corbyn is going to come with a big speech and to tell us that it is the foreign wars, and once he's the prime minister, we won't be involved in foreign wars. Are there really foreign wars? They aren't. Syria, Iraq, Libya, Iran. Who are the lobbies that pushing us into these wars? It is one tribal lobby. It's AIPAC in America. It's the CFI here. Before that, it was the LFI, for those who don't know. It's Conservative Friends of Israel, or before, Labour Friends of Israel. It's the CRIF in France. So if Corbyn cannot even say the J word or the Z word when he refers to foreign wars, he cannot tell the truth.
I'm going to argue.
He's a Jerusalemite.
I'm going to argue with you there.
Yeah.
I can see why you'd go as far as that, and I would agree with you. But I don't think he needed even to mention the J or the Z word when he talked about, you know, the consequences of interventions. He didn't go far enough. Corbyn could have pointed out that there is empirical evidence that the intelligence agencies of Western countries create these groups, these fictional entities. I mean, we even have a reality where Andrew Neil interviewed Corbyn the other night and told a whopping great lie at the beginning of the programme when he said ISIS were around even before the Iraq war. Massive lie. Corbyn could have jumped in and said, well, actually, no. These terror groups are the figment of the imagination of the Western intelligence agencies. In fact, they're real people. They are real lunatic jihadis, but they have been set to burn and to bomb and to maim on our behalf to fulfil another agenda. Now, you and I know the part Israel plays in that, but he didn't even have to go down the Israeli road to tell the truth, right?
This is fine. I'm fine with what you're saying. Okay, it could be really more precise. For me, I brought this example as an example of a Jerusalemite behavior. Why didn't go there? Why didn't mention the J word or alternatively or Z word, Zionist, or if you want the Western intelligence services? Because he subscribes, he adheres to the tyranny of correctness.
Yeah.
Now, the tyranny of correctness is really where my book, Being and Time...
Central theme in the book. This is really important. Let me just then very quickly... the book is Being in Time, a Post-Political Manifesto by Gilad Atman. I'll tell you what we're going to do, my friend. And I know we are recording this. We're going to take a 60-second, very quick 60-second break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the tyranny of political correctness and identity politics, you know, people starting to view the world from the absolute position of I am a Jew, I am a Muslim, I am whatever. We're going to get into that. Gilad Atman is our guest. This break really is only 60 seconds, Gilad, so I am going to take it. And we'll be back with more from Gilad in exactly 60 seconds.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbayerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Welcome back to the programme. It is Tuesday, the 30th of May 2017. Gilad Atman is our guest, the great jazz saxophonist and author, political thinker, critical thinker and philosopher. He's got a book out called Being in Time, a Post-Political Manifesto. Go to gilad.co.uk. I'm also going to put links out to where you can buy the book. It is terrific. It's well worth a look. Published by Skyscraper. Gilad, thanks for staying with us.
Man, pleasure.
Really good stuff this, mate. We're going to move on to talk about, we have been talking about democracy, the illusory nature of it, the left-right paradigm, where that comes from. We have a lot more to talk about as well. Identity politics in the face of the election of Donald Trump, because obviously there are, not a profound reason, but one of the reasons you got into writing this book and why you rolled your sleeves up and began to write it, a lot of it had to do with the run-up to, as much as the election itself, the run-up to the election in the United States, right? And the aftermath. Go ahead.
Yeah, the thing is that what we see in Britain at the moment is not very different. The issue that we really have to, we noticed in Britain, in France, in the last election, as we all know, the two major parties were wiped out. In Brexit, tonight I'm in Scotland. We saw it in Scotland. One of the most crucial things that the left must be aware of, but I guess that by the time they become aware of it, they stop being leftists, is the embarrassing fact that utopia, the vision of a great future, is in practice nostalgia. American blue-collar workers voted to Donald Trump because he promised to make America great again. He was fiddling with their nostalgic sense. The same applies to Britain. It is nostalgia that fueled the Brexit campaign. Something is not right in this progressive dystopia. So I decided to look, what is it in progressive dystopia? And it didn't take me that long to find that there are two destructive elements that have managed to ruin our life, our ruin of togetherness, our humanity. And interestingly enough, both of these elements were introduced to us, I believe genuinely, in goodwill. The first one, and you touched it, is identity politics. By now, we have been trained to think as a Jew, as a black, as a lesbian, as a transgender, as a Muslim, and so on and so on. What we saw in America, in an American election, the American voters were pretty much split between the as a, the people who identify sectarianly with identity politics, think as a Hispanic, as a independent women, as feminist, as Jews, and so on and so on, and those who identify primarily as Americans. The Americans voted for Trump. The Eze voted for Hillary Clinton. In Brexit, it's the same. The people who identify as English or Brits or whatever, at large, want to split from the rest of the continent, or from the EU, not geographically split, but the identity split. And the Eze want to retain this kind of global agenda. Now, I started to look into it and try to identify how these ideas that are divisive and at large divide us on base of biology became so popular in our midst. And I tell you why it is very interesting for me. Because to identify with a biology is to adopt really the most embarrassing aspect of Hitler's philosophy. I don't have a big problem between the two of us. I don't have a problem at all with the idea of socialism and nationalism, or if you say the other way around, is national socialism. I don't have the idea of people in one place living in equality amongst themselves. This was the idea of Italian fascism, socialism of the Italian people. This was the idea of the national German national socialists. They spoke about equality of German-speaking people. By the way, this is not how we studied it in schools. Equality of German-speaking people, and this explains why the Anschluss was so popular in Austria. It explained the early conflict with the Czechoslovakia and the Sudeten and so on and so on. Hitler had a different idea. Hitler spoke about equality of one race. Now, this is a very problematic concept, because if you are born in a place and you don't belong to the right race, you have a problem. What is so embarrassing is that the left actually adopted this biologically determined politics. Women who identify politically with the womanness, black who identify with the skin of their color, Jews who identify with the genes of their mothers, and so on and so on. This is very, very problematic. And why is it problematic? It is very problematic because Richie, I don't know, maybe you changed radically since I saw you last time, but you won't be able to become the head of a Jewish left organization.
No.
You know why? Because you're not racially qualified.
Yeah.
All right? And the same applies to you when it comes to black organization. Not because you don't support black rights or human rights, just because you're not qualified racially. Now, how did the left adopt such moronic
nonsense
ideology,
yeah,
that is in complete opposition to left philosophy?
Sorry for interrupting. Before you qualify and quantify why you think the left objected it, I've got to interject and say, I can't disagree. I want to badly disagree with you to give you a right good going over. But it's not easy because I agree with you. But where I disagree is you, I know you believe this, that initially this came out of, it was well-intentioned. But I'm going to argue with you. You and I have a mutual friend. Our listeners will groan because they're probably sick of me mentioning his name, but I've got to. I went to see David Icke some years ago, and David talked at length about a guy called Dr. Richard Day, who made some revelations back in the late 1960s about the plans for the future world war in the 21st century. I think he was a professor of pediatrics at a medical school in New York. And he talked at length about the imposition of these ideas on people, you know, ideas, you know, like, you know, fashion, sexuality, sexualization of children, euthanasia, all these things, the media, population control, loads of stuff like that. And one of the ways this would be, one of the ways it could be introduced and this agenda could be served would be through programs like, of course, political correctness and newspeak and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I would argue that, and I've not done the research you've done, but have you considered that the imposition of this agenda wasn't well intentioned? In fact, it was always negative from the word go. What do you think?
You know, to start, what can I say? I want to believe that there was a good intention there. I don't mind. It doesn't interfere
with my
description of our dystopic conditions. I want to believe, you know, that people, a mass, bought into the idea of political correctness because they saw anti-black racism, and they could see that gays were discriminated, and women, you know, and so on and so on. So even if there was a sinister agenda behind it, it became successful
because of the good nature of people, because people are good-natured, and you don't want to see
people are good-natured.
Fair
exactly.
Enough, fair
all right. So. In fact, when you look, when you read my the Being in Time, and you see why it evolved, you may come to the conclusion that it wasn't as innocent as I tried to suggest. And I was just about to explain why it happened. So, the left, the question that I asked just before you raised very important question.
How did the left accept it, right? How come the left came to accept this? That's where we were moving.
Exactly. Yeah. This is the question. And I came to the conclusion, and I'm not very original here, I'm not the first one to come up with it, that there is a deep animosity embedded in left ideology, in left circles and left intellectual circles especially, towards the working class, the working people. And why? Because the working people never vote Labour. They vote Tories, they vote Trump, they like Le Pen, and so on and so on. And this is the reason that actually the guy that probably was most influential in the early days, who understood that the way around it is cultural Marxism, as opposed to traditional Marxism, and I'll explain it in a second, was Gramsci. Gramsci realized that the revolution is not going to happen because the working class go to work. They are not interested in those sophisticated models, Marxist models of shifting of labor and division of labor and so on and so on. By the way, Marx is quite complicated. Even those who claim to understand Marx and teach it in university don't really understand it. Gramsci came with the idea of changing the hegemony, attacking the sources of culture, intellectual powers. And this idea was very quickly adopted by the Frankfurt School, which was basically a German Jewish Marxist psychoanalytical school of thought. They formed this different ideologies, actually, that were there to bring a change, what they believed to be a change in society that would introduce a shift. For instance, they thought Wilhelm Reich, that was a cultural Marxist but wasn't part of the Frankfurt School, thought that the way to do it is to introduce a sex revolution. He thought that the fascism occurred in Germany because the German people are overwhelmingly conservatives, you know, they patriarchal society and so on and so on. Liberating the women, sexualizing kids, he thought would be the right way forward. This idea was adopted pretty much by Marcuse from the Frankfurt School. They came with all those ideas that were basically there to dismantle every form or sense of rootedness in Western thought. Now, the Germans didn't like it, apparently. They had to run away from Hitler in 1933. They moved to America. The Americans were not vigilant enough, and these schools of thought became totally dominant in America, especially after 68, after the student revolution. What is totally amazing for you Brits is the fact that Mr. George Orwell actually understood all of it already in 48, when he wrote 1984.
Because he was an insider.
In 48, only this is an amazing historical fact that must be addressed. I tried to do it in the book. He understood that we are moving towards tyranny of correctness. Now, why I mention tyranny of correctness now? Because one of the reasons that we couldn't detect what is going on around us is because of political correctness. The first thing that they did was restricting the way we think. What is political correctness? Political correctness is politics that doesn't allow political opposition.
No. We must all think the same way. We must all have the same opinion on any given issue at any time.
Exactly. Now, politics that doesn't allow political opposition is exactly the definition of tyranny. But in tyranny, you are opposing an external entity, whether it is Stalin or Hitler or Tony Blair. Yeah. In the case of political correctness, they make us into our own tyrants. It's self-suppression.
Self-censorship, yeah.
Self-censorship, self-suppression. And the way they do it, they plant a Trojan horse in our brain. It starts to blip when we think authentically. The next time, we would avoid saying what we think. And the third time, We just learn how not to think. So if you ask yourself, how is it possible that all those transitions took place in front of our eyes and the academia didn't warn us, the media didn't warn us, it was only David Icke.
It was only David. There's no doubt about that. But within academia, there have been men and women trying to attack this. And I'm going to mention one or two of them in a minute. But I am going to quickly...
And what was their fate?
Often what they're marginalised, and in some cases they lose tenure and they're moved on. But listen, I'm going to mention the book is Being in Time, a post-political manifesto by Gilad Atzmon. In case you're just tuning into the programme, the entire interview will be on podcast after the programme and it'll be on YouTube, it'll be on davidicke.com tomorrow, we'll share it all over. Now, Mr. Atzmon, before we delve deeper into the political correctness agenda and its impact on society, I'm going to reverse the car back about 50 yards there because I'm not letting you away. I've read the book. I know you are going to be interviewed by many people who didn't read the book. I read the book, right? I've got it in my hand and I read it and I like it. And I know our listeners are going to read it. And when they read it, like me, they're going to be dismayed with the dismissive, I suppose, attitude that you have to the importance of Dr. Wilhelm Reich. And I know you talked about him not going to the Frankfurt School. I know you talked about his relationship with Marxism, but I think there's an awful lot more to Reich. And ironically, you are the second jazz musician legend that I've gotten to know over the years. Ironically, the other one is a man called Peter Ind. And I've spent many hours talking to Peter about the work of Wilhelm Reich on Orgone Energy, that omnipresent energy that he wrote about and worked with. And I believe there was a reason Reich, however you pronounce it, why his work was destroyed, why he was jailed, because there's a lot more to him than meets the eye.
I must save you the trouble.
I wouldn't expect you to get into that in the book, obviously.
I must save you the trouble.
But I have a lot of time for Reich.
Notice I didn't write about the Oregon.
No, you didn't. No.
Energy. I didn't feel that I am clever enough or educated enough to pass any judgment on it. I only dealt with Reich on sexuality, Reich the cultural Marxist. I attack, and I admit, I attack a certain path within that was dominant in the early days. I concentrate on that.
Can I say something? The book is no less an excellent read because of it. It's no less. Yeah. Anybody reading it would totally understand why you didn't go down that road. But I came to read a lot about Reich over the years, and I just wanted to make that point. Before we go back to political correctness, Gilad Atzmon is our guest, folks. Read the book. It's a terrific read. It's an important read this year. Believe me, I mean that sincerely. Gilad.co.uk. No, it really is. Have you got an ounce of spirituality in your body, Atzmon, or are you completely left-brained? Is my next question. Before we move on to further exploring political correctness, go ahead.
You know, I'll make it very simple for you. I'm a musician. And I'm not an educated musician. You know, nowadays, a lot of musicians, they go to Royal Academy and so on and so on. I'm not an educated musician, which means that I don't really know what I'm doing. But apparently it works. Okay? And I'm deeply convinced that the human nature reaches its most when spirituality is involved. And the last thing that I want to do, and you won't find it in my writing, and this may give the impression that I'm left brain.
No, I'm not trying to give that impression.
Because the one thing that I never do is fiddling with my spirituality. It's, for me, it's a black box. I nourish it. You know, I see myself as a musician, as the guy who carried the saxophone. Once I start to play, it is the moment I get lost where I really become the audience of my own music. So I definitely, deeply, I don't have any issue with spirituality. And in fact, I think that this is another thing, you know, this pseudo image of a scientific, rational Western world is very troubling for me. Because, you know, yesterday when I came to the Clooney, I saw people behaving in the most emotional, yeah. I'm talking about the owner of the place and few of his staff, you know, that they reacted, you know, we have some troubling images of so-called Nazis abusing, you know, Jews and, you know, quite horrifying images. And the one thing that you ask yourself, you know, without saying right, wrong, is how people, you know, manage together. How did it happen to, this is the common question, the most sophisticated nation in Europe managed to go to get to this place. And yesterday when I came to the Clooney, this is exactly what I thought. And this is actually the lack of spirituality.
Yeah.
The pseudo factual universe where you actually learn to believe false news as if they are facts.
Without questioning.
Yeah.
Without questioning. Yeah,
without,
I mean, the last thing I would say on the spirituality is, I mean, I've come to believe that, you know, the system that you describe in the book is ultimately there to prevent us. It's putting firewalls in the way of us understanding what we are and what we're capable of, you know, our consciousness and where it could go, not to get all spirituality spiritual about it. The book is outstanding because you're dealing with these issues in a way that I think is going to be a fantastic way in for people. You see, I mentioned Adam Curtis earlier on. His films were a fantastic way in for people who've been spoon-fed by the BBC and the Daily Mail for years. And your books are like that, and this book is like that as well. It's essential reading for people coming to understand
that. It is amazing
that
you mention it, because I mentioned it to the to my publisher, and I asked him to try to find Adam Curtis and to invite him to our London launch in a few days, because I feel the same about Adam Curtis, and especially the Century of the Self. Although I don't agree with some of his conclusions, but the form of questioning is very similar.
It's excellent.
And once you start to engage in questioning, it doesn't matter if you reach different answers, because the questioning is the most important element.
It is, because it elevates our consciousness ultimately.
Exactly.
Anyway. And before we go back, because I want you to go back and I want you to finish. We got about 15, 20 minutes left. And I want you to talk more about this incredible identity politics agenda, how it goes hand in hand with political correctness. I'm going to offer one more criticism, but it's not from me. I know that when your enemies read the book, I know what they're going to say. They're going to pick out bits of the book that suit themselves. You talk a lot about mammonism in the book, and people are going to say, there goes Gilad again. He's equating or intrinsically linking mammonism with Jewish identity. That's a nasty old stereotype. Now, I know this isn't true because I've read the book, but that's what is going to be thrown at you. You know this anyway, don't you? You just accept this and that's the way it is.
Yeah, I accept it. And to be honest with you, I fiddle with it.
Right.
I let them do it. When I found out that they misquote me, what would happen, a lot of people would be outraged, and many other people will actually find it interesting and may read the book and understand what is my intellectual project. The thing is, the book is divided into two. First, I define this notion of post-political condition. And I use in the book a kind of a metaphor that I think that is very useful. You know, you live in Manchester, you see it in Manchester, in London, in Paris, in New York, probably Moscow. I never been in Moscow, by the way.
Me neither.
We see all those glass skyscrapers. And you ask yourself, why do they make them with glass? Because they're occupied by bankers, HSBC, Goldman Sachs, and so on and so on. And the reason, I believe, I may be wrong, it's probably cheap as well, is that it conveys the image of transparency. You see, we have this glass, we have nothing to hide. We are fragile, in fact.
Absolutely.
But when you get very close to these buildings and you try to peep in because you think that it's transparent, you realize that it's not a transparent glass, it's actually a mirror.
Yeah, yeah.
When you try to look in, all you see is yourself standing out in the cold in the street.
And that's an amazing metaphor, right?
Thank you. But this is exactly the post-political condition. How did we fall into this trap? Let these people take over and leave us alone in the cold, in the street. Now, I devoted half of the book. It's a pretty short book, I think. And I hope that it's an easy read. Half of the book describes what does it mean to be in a post-political world, universe, or whatever. And I talk about the left and the right and political correctness and identity politics and so on and so on. The second part of the book, and now I'm kind of trying to address your question, and you are absolutely right to ask this question, which something that I myself troubled with my writing, is an attempt to understand why Jerusalem has become so dominant in this transition, in this post-political universe, and more specifically, why Jewish lobbies, Jewish persons are, again, so dominant within our culture, within our finance, within our political lobbying. And I actually think that I'm doing a great service for the Jews as a tribe in this book. Why? Because when I looked into it, it was very easy for me to find out that it's not the Jews. It's not the Jews as a tribe. There is something that I define in the book as a Jewish elite. And this Jewish elite is extremely sophisticated, collective. And I explain how did they become so sophisticated. And it's not that the Jews are very clever, because if you look at what I'm doing in the book and I analyze the demography of Jews and the relationship between the Jews and their elite, it's actually elite that is a product of 1500 years of a eugenic exercise. You know, and I can extend it, or maybe I'll just mention it because I think that it's very interesting. In the Jewish rabbinical universe, the European Jewish universe, they explored for 1500 years, it's quite a long time, a very unique exercise. They used to marry the sage, the young rabbinical protege, the boy that is destined to become a Talmudic genius, with the daughter of the leading merchant. with the daughter of the guy, what they call the Gvir, the guy who make who basically funds the entire society and so on and so on and so on. They basically created the elite that was specializing in money and scholarship. And it wasn't a racist or eugenic project from their perspectives, because they were living in isolation and they wanted to be managed or ruled by people who can sustain their existence in hostile conditions. However, what happened is once emancipation was at play, and we are talking about the 19th century since the French Revolution and so on, Enlightenment, Jews are emancipated, and from that moment on, within just few years, Jewish seculars, members of that Jewish elite, are becoming the most dominant people in Europe. When it comes to banking and finance, we can talk about the Rothschild and few other families. I mentioned the families in the book, but it wasn't just that. We can talk about Freud and Marx and Einstein and so on and so on. And European elite are extremely upset with it. And to a certain extent, you know, the rise of Nazism in Germany has something to do with it, because they blamed at large Jewish elite for their failure in different fields, including the defeat in the war. So I actually manage in the book to argue, to actually, I think, to prove that it's not the Jews, it is a sector within the Jewish elite. And if I'll tell you something intimate, it is more than likely that I myself managed to understand it because I myself an offspring of that elite.
Yeah, you're intimately acquainted with it because of your own lineage, your own heritage, right?
Yeah. Which is you know, something that, you know, there is nothing I can do about it.
But I try to
facilitate my ability to think about these things and to turn it into a humanist agenda.
Well, look, we could spend all day. I think we have discussed in the past the old money of the European royal families and the new money of the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and the Warburgs and these families, how they, as David would describe, interbred. There's no doubt about the significance of that. The growth of Zionism, what was behind that, the families who supported Hitler. These are incredible themes that you've explored in your writing and in your book. I'm going to mention the book again. We've got about 5 minutes, I reckon. That's flown by, Gilad. I can't believe it. Being in Time, a Post-Political Manifesto, by Gilad Atzmon, the terrific jazz saxophonist, writer and critical thinker. It's an attempt to understand how we got to where we are now, how we've reached this paradigm. I mean, you talk about intellectual developments. I mean, you lament that intellectualism is basically dead, isn't it? We live in a soundbite world.
By the way, I don't think that it is dead. It is suppressed.
Suppressed.
I think one of the things that happened to me in my last tour in America, I started to see right-wing intellectuals. In one of the events, I had kind of, it was 60, 70 people in the room, and I had a group of white identitarians. Now, my book is critical of identity politics, and this includes also white identitarians. I noticed that when I presented my criticism, they listened to it, and the reaction was, We have to think about it. So they see themselves as a dynamic discourse that attempts to realize itself. I get a lot of criticism. My event tonight is not cancelled. You know, when you will, when this talk will be on, yeah. I'll be talking in
Edinburgh. No?
In Edinburgh. The lady who cancelled the event in her bookshop, Mary is named the Lighthouse Radical Bookshop. Apparently, I'm too radical for the Edinburgh Radical Bookshop. She said, I don't have any doubt that Gilad is not a hate speaker, but he doesn't mind to share a platform with people who are hate speakers. No, I don't know who are the people she refers to, because I don't remember myself ever sharing platform with anyone who preached hate it's complete nonsense. But what is very interesting for me is those people whom the left are dissing as barbarians, as deplorable, rednecks, and so on and so on, actually are more inclined towards intellectual exploration, self-reflection, self-questioning than anyone I've ever met in the Palestinian Solidarity Movement.
That's an amazing irony, isn't it?
It is an amazing irony, and it is very, very disappointing for me, because the left has managed brutally to shoot itself in the foot.
I get it all the time, Gilad. We often invite journalists who may have written articles about social justice for The Guardian or for The Independent, and I will drop them an email. And on many occasions, they will respond with but you interviewed somebody who wants to investigate the Holocaust, or you're associated with somebody, or whatever. And it's an incredibly suppressive, as you said a minute ago. It's so counterproductive and it's so self-censoring. And I don't understand how these people can't see how it leads to self-censorship and it leads to no discourse whatsoever. I mean, I'm amazed. I haven't encountered, but I completely believe what you're saying, that on the far right...
And this is the issue. And somebody yesterday in the Clooney telling me exactly, yeah. Said, yeah, but you... And I said, yes, this is my human duty, and our human duty is to cross the divide, to talk to anyone, absolutely, to talk to the people we don't agree with. How is it possible that the left wants to convince the working people to support the revolution or political change or whatever, the move forward towards a progressive future, if they cannot even talk
without talking to them.
people to people they may disagree with? I want to talk to anyone. This is why I have an issue with the BDS, cultural BDS. I will share a platform and debate an ultra Zionist with no hesitation, for sure.
We're just about out of time. I'm going to give another mention to the title of the book. It's Being in Time, a Post-Political Manifesto by Gilad Asmon. I'm strongly recommending the book. I can't recommend it really any higher than I have. It's been endorsed by the great Cynthia McKinney, Francis Boyle, and others. It's an easy read. It's tackling complicated and complex subjects in a really interesting way, in an easy to understand way. It's humorous at times. It's terrific, mate. I'm going to give
Thank
you
so much. I'm so happy that you liked it, and really, really, really appreciate.
You had the courtesy of sending me the book a couple of weeks in advance, which doesn't always happen. So I'm going to give you the final word, mate, today, and then we'll part company, and I'm sure you'll be back on again soon. So you have the final word then on where we are and where we're going.
I wish I had a final
statement.
You know, for us, the thing that made the West a great environment is the heritage of freedom. It's the Athenian idea of thinking freely, debating. Unless we find out immediately how to reinstate this that made us so great, we are doomed. And I'm fighting for it. This is my war.
Listen, have a brilliant gig in Edinburgh tonight. This will be going out while you're taking the stage to talk.
Thank you so much.
Folks, go to gilad.co.uk. Gilad Athman, always a pleasure.
Love you, brother. Bye-bye.
Yeah, the amazing Gilad Athman in conversation with me a little bit earlier on. In fact, it was in the mid-morning. And we ran out of time because he had to leave for Edinburgh. We were going to do an hour. We'd done about an hour and 15 minutes. You can get the book... Being in Time, a post-political manifesto. You can get it at amazon.co.uk or amazon.com. For more details, go to gilad.co.uk. Fascinating conversation. I think fascinating to hear what he had to say, and the book is incredibly fascinating. Very quick break, back in a minute.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbayerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
One of the things I wanted to get into with Gilad, and we didn't have time, and I was speaking with David early this morning. We were talking about a video that went viral about the BBC and how some sections of the independent media grabbed a video from the BBC and alleged that the date of the video, the 22nd, the day of the attack, and the video was of a police officer giving an update about the bombing. And people were saying, well, this was evidence that a video was made before the bombing of the police giving a briefing, which would lead people to conclude that the whole thing was staged. Well, it turned out that the video was... it turned out that the timestamp on the video... The video had been made on Pacific time. That the department of the BBC had made and uploaded the video. It was done on Pacific time, meaning that there wasn't anything really untoward with the video, if you understand, and the timing of its uploading to YouTube, but people jumped on it. And that got me thinking about my conversation with Gilad and the independent media. And I was going to ask him, what will it mean for people? Because much of the so-called independent media is... You see, I mentioned after the monologue that I wanted to explore this today, and maybe I should leave it alone. Maybe I should leave it alone now as we approach the end of the programme, and maybe we should get into it tomorrow. But much of the independent media, I would say 99% of it, mirrors the mainstream media in how it goes about doing what it does, in how it operates, in how it ultimately serves the system. And I was going to ask Gilad about what part will that play when people come to understand that, when people come to realise that everything, or nearly everything, is empty, is without merit, and is false, is fake. What will that mean for people? And I was going to throw, it would have been the wrong thing to do. I was going to throw the Ken O'Keefe scenario. Not to keep beating up Ken criminal and all as he is, not to keep bashing him because there are so many like him. But what will that mean for people when they come to realise that nearly everything they hold sacred, including their independent media, is utterly fake, is shallow, is hollow, and is without any merit? And I want to explore that in the coming weeks in the programme. In fact, in the coming days. And I was going to get into it after the monologue tonight, and I decided not to because we were running out of time. It's a hugely important area, I think, of research that we have to get into. Peter Richmond tweeted me, probably thinking I was speaking with Gillard Live. Peter, thanks for your comment. Richie, what about ideas that religion was in fact a commercial business, and what would Gillard's view on religion be? Well, he does dissect it in the book, Peter. I recommend you read the book. I do recommend it, and I'm not easily bought. I'm not cheap. I'm recommending the book because I read it and I really liked it. My take personally on religion, through my development, through my understanding that, again, everything is an illusion, everything is fake, and everything plays a part. Not everything, but nearly everything plays a part in preventing us from understanding what reality is. I believe that we know where religions came from through the research of Jordan and David and others. We know where religions ultimately came from and how the Judeo-Christian Islamic model, the Abrahamic religions, how those religions were basically offsets of, and they were basically follow-ons from the ancient Greek gods and so on. I won't bore you with that because you know that intimately. I've just always believed that the elite saw great opportunities in religion in terms of keeping people controlled, you know, by using the stories, the parables, the idea of the benevolent creator. I think the elite saw the opportunities to promote those religions insofar as that those religions could do the elite's job for them, to keep people under control, to keep people in a state of conformity. I think over the years, I think, you know, Gillard's spoken a lot about those issues, and he certainly tackles those issues in the book. It's exactly 7 minutes to the top of the hour. That is kind of it for the Tuesday edition of the Richie Allen Show. I will be speaking with Vicky Haig on the programme tomorrow. Victoria Haig will be live on the show from France. That's one you don't want to miss. We will be back to the television show this Thursday. So the live television show begins again on Thursday at 9 p.m. from BVTV. That to be broadcast on BVTV and Facebook and YouTube and whatnot as well. So we'll be doing that on Thursday. So I will be updating our website, richieallen.co.uk, I'm going to update the website to reflect the schedule, so that the schedule won't be confusing. It's going to be Sunday View at 11 on Sunday morning. It's going to be live radio at 7 p.m. UK time, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. The live TV show on Thursday. And in principle, we'll do a weekly news roundup live on Friday as well. So it'll be 6 live shows a week. That's the way it's going to be ongoing. Look, that's kind of it for the programme today. I hope you enjoyed listening to Gilad Atzmon, Top Man. The book can be bought, by the way, at all good online retailers, but do go to amazon.co.uk or amazon.com and check out Gilad's website. It's gilad.co.uk. That's gilad.co.uk. If there is somebody you'd like me to get in touch with for the programme, you can email me. My email address is richie@richieallen.co.uk. That's richie@richieallen.co.uk. Drop me a line. Where feasible, I will endeavour to get the guest on. I've not too many times over the 3 years said to somebody, well, I don't want to get that person on or that person or him or her on. if there is somebody you want to hear in the program, let me know. And generally, 99 times out of 100, we can get them on the program and chat with them on this particular show. I will mention again, the program is dependent on your support, your financial support. Only if you can, do support us by going to paypal.me/Richie Allen. That's paypal.me/Richie Allen. But there are bank account details on our website. So if you want to do it by bank transfer, it's richieallen.co.uk. Now, davidicke.com, through Jamie Icke, who's producing David's Worldwide Wake Up Tour, have announced today that in 2018, there are going to be a series of events in the UK with David in the evening. A series of four-hour events with David in the evening. Go to davidicke.com and bookmark davidicke.com for more information on that. There was a lot of interest in that today when it was mentioned. Throughout 2018, David will be doing evening events for 4 hours, the duration of somewhere between 3.5 and 4 hours. And he's going right across the UK doing those. Pretty exciting times for everybody associated with that. davidicke.com for more details on that. Wanted to mention that a bit earlier on as well. So that's it then for Tuesday's programme. Join me tomorrow, Wednesday, for the Wednesday edition at 7 p.m. UK time, to 7 p.m. UK time. Vicky Haig will be among the guests. You don't want to miss that. She's terrific, and it's been quite a while since she was on the Richie Allen show. Going to leave you with some Bruce Springsteen. The Gillard interview will be on YouTube overnight. The podcast of this programme will be online in about 20 minutes time. Do share it on social media when you see it appear. Until tomorrow, Tuesday, look after yourselves and one another. Thanks for listening to the programme. Bye for now. See you tomorrow.
Whispering as the rain on the streets of Philadelphia.